This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to another COVID-19 special edition of AMDA On The Go. Given the fluidity of issues and mandates around the pandemic here in the United States, there continue to be a number of considerations around the management of COVID-19 within the healthcare continuum, and this episode will focus on the collaborative effort that led to the implementation guide for improving medication management in post-acute and long-term care settings during the COVID-19 pandemic. 20 years ago, as a geriatric fellow, one of my first patients was a 96-year-old gentleman who told me that he had been the chief pharmacist at a major Boston medical center decades before. Back in my day, he said, we pretty much had a handful of medications, and what we didn't have, we would compound from the garden and back. Well, today, according to the Food and Drug Administration, there are over 20,000 drug products approved for marketing. Becker's Hospital Review of the 10 most prescribed medications include those that would make any geriatrician take pause. According to Statista.com, in 2019, 4.38 billion retail prescriptions were slated to be filled throughout the United States. And a Georgetown University Health Policy Institute white paper made the bold, albeit sad, commentary, people with chronic conditions depend on prescription drugs. Depend on prescription drugs. Is that really true? Well, in 2013, in a perspective piece in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Nancy Morden and others discussed accountable prescribing and wrote that clinicians frequently prescribe medications that improve numbers without necessarily improving health. So maybe people with chronic diseases don't depend on prescription medications. And maybe medications can be appropriately removed or reduced, the process that we today call deprescribing. And just maybe the COVID-19 pandemic is a time in which thoughtful considerations about medications can lead to significant and beneficial changes for those individuals most affected by COVID-19, like those in the skilled nursing facility. And maybe there could be a medication management program as that proposed by geriatric medicine educators and thought and change leaders, Drs. Michael Steinman and Nicole Brandt, that can actually facilitate change in medication management during this most challenging time. Well, how fortunate are we to have Dr. Steinman and Dr. Brandt with us now to help us navigate through this concept and discuss their novel program. Dr. Michael Steinman is a professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco and the San Francisco VA Medical Center. He is the co-chair of the American Geriatric Society Beers Criteria Guideline Committee. He is the co-principal investigator of the NIH-funded United States Deprescribing Research Network. And Dr. Nicole Brandt has a doctorate in pharmacy and a master's in business administration and is a fellow of the American Society of Consultant Pharmacists. She is the executive director for the Peter Lamy Center on Drug Therapy and Aging and a professor in pharmacy practice and science at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. She is a clinical pharmacist at the MedStar Center for Successful Aging. Drs. Steinman and Brandt, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Steinman, I'll start with you. The Journal of the American Geriatric Society, JAGS, and the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association, JAMDA, are replete with articles that discuss the concept of deprescribing, and even in some cases provide tools in order to do so. Canada also has a deprescribing network, and a variety of national societies have made deprescribing a focal point. There have been discussions around systems integration, communication, and barriers to the deprescribing process discussed in a variety of arenas, including a number of times on this podcast. And many of our JOAMDAs in the trenches, as I like to call them, you know, daily work to eliminate vitamins, proton pump inhibitors, and statins when possible. And yet they continue to wonder if they have made a dent in care. Many of our facility consultant pharmacists are very involved in the process, but their time is fleeting with the teams. Number of questions to start off. You know, what is the difficulty around being able to accomplish a task of reducing, changing, or eliminating medication in our adult or adult population? You know, why do we still need such advocacy? And the really tough question is if we can't do it, if we can't do deprescribing or medication management during a time of relative calm, how can we even approach such medical management processes during this crisis when the stress factor in nursing facilities is at a peak? Nursing facilities are in the spotlight, staffing is stressed, and our residents are dying.
Well, a series of great questions, and as you might imagine, there's no sort of single pat answer to that, but maybe I'll take a stab at some of the key issues. So as you alluded to, this is an incredibly challenging problem, and even though in the last few years there's been a real surge of interest and efforts to try to address it, you know, we're only making small progress, and that's because it is really challenging. And as, you know, I'm a clinician and Nikki's a clinician, and, you know, we have, a kind of a gut sense of knowing that, you know, this is much easier said than done. And then it's almost always easier just to keep a medication as is than it is to change it, particularly to stop or reduce it. And some of the barriers that can often come from that are, to a certain extent, technical barriers, knowing about, you know, what's the right way to stop or to taper down a medication. But a lot of the biggest barriers are really barriers related to emotion and information. So some of the information barriers can be, you know, patients taking a medicine. I'm not sure why they're taking this medicine. It was prescribed by some other clinician. And therefore, I feel uncomfortable at stopping it because I don't know if I'm going to do more harm or good. And then, of course, there's the emotion from the clinician's side, feeling like if I stop that and something bad happens to the patient, that's scary. And then of course the patient themselves or their caregiver or loved one might also have concerns about stopping the medication for the same reason. There's the fear of the unknown. If I stop it, what will happen to me? And so a lot of the attempts to think about deprescribing really need to think about it, not just from this technical aspect, but really attend to these issues of information transfer and emotion. And that brings us back to the question of why now in COVID-19. If this is hard in the best of circumstances, you know, why should we even be thinking about it at a time when we're all stressed? It is hard. But, you know, the fact that COVID-19 is a crisis also really presents an opportunity. We're in a time when we're shaking a lot of things up and we're changing a lot of practices that have been in place for a long time. And it really presents an opportunity to kind of think more broadly about how can we best care for patients in a way that manages, that reduces their risk of getting COVID-19, and at the same time actually improves their health. And if there are synergies here, by we're improving their medication management and making it simpler and better, that we can actually protect them from COVID, relieve some of the burden on staff in these facilities and help the patient, then that's a win all the way around. And so if we can really capitalize on the momentum that COVID has brought us and the willingness to kind of try new and hard things, I think it really presents an opportunity to do a lot of good.
And Wayne, just to add to Dr. Steinman's great response, I think as he articulated, things are shaken up. And conversations are being had that may have not been had before in terms of what our patients, our residents' priorities of care are. So I think it's a perfect time to really look at those goals of care and look at the medication regimen. And by doing this, we may also reduce the burden on that direct care staff in terms of numbers of medications they have to pass and the potential negative implications of some of these medications that need to be monitored. So I just wanted to add that perspective to Dr. Steinman's response.
You know, Dr. Brandt, in 1976, a gentleman named Myron Weiner wrote an article in the Journal of Medical Economics entitled, "Don't Waste a Crisis, Your Patients or Your Own." Everyone thinks Rahm Emanuel said, "Crisis is the best time to do things," but I guess it actually goes back a number of years before. In consideration that a crisis does present a moment for opportunity, lead us through how you came together to develop this guide. How did you envision an evidence-based, person-centered care approach? What were your thoughts around optimizing communication as resistance to medication changes, as Dr. Steinman already said, has been seen as a barrier with both patients and providers? Were there potential unintended consequences in carrying out recommendations from the guide that you realized and needed to address as well?
Thank you, Wayne, for those multiple questions and a little bit of a history lesson too. So let me give you a little bit of history about the medication management guide that Dr. Steinman and our team put together. It really came out of being a clinically based practitioner and academician and someone who loves to bring people together for good purposes and causes such as this. And it really stemmed out of our team clinical huddles where I heard our direct care team struggling with all of the burden in the nursing home segment, which too often than not, at least I perceive, Wayne, sometimes gets forgotten about in terms of all the things that they're trying to work through and work with. So not only did we have a shortage in staff and shortage of PPE, we just had a lot of concern in terms of transmission of COVID and how we manage it in a non-hospital setting. So I say that because when we thought about it as a team, I thought of myself as a pharmacist on the team as how can we look at reducing medication burden? How can we simplify some of the demands on the workforce? So I called up Dr. Steinman because of our work with the USD Prescribing Research Network, and we bantered back and forth, and we put together an interprofessional team of experts who've done work both in the practice and done it from a regulatory perspective, and put together this medication management guide in a little under 2 weeks, which seems insurmountable when you think about the amount has gone into it and the work. But really, as you articulated already, a lot of work has already been done on deprescribing. And why we put it in the facet in the format that we did in terms of implementation and recommendations really centered at a resident-centered or person-centered care approach, because the nursing homes, we call them residents. And we felt that this was a great time to, again, open up the conversations to optimizing medications, not just deprescribing medications, but optimizing medications and what our residents, what these individuals need most at this time. But we realized as we do that, we have to be very mindful of some of the perception that could happen, those unintended consequences. So we felt it was imperative that we had good communication strategies, engaging not just the resident, but the people that care for them, such as the direct care staff, their family members, and others within a facility. And it really takes an interprofessional, interdisciplinary, team-based approach to make changes, such as medication regimen changes. But we realize when you do any sort of change, there's always uncertainty of what might be some of those unintended consequences, such as could there be a return of symptoms when we stop these medications. So it's important that you monitor the patient closely and reevaluate if medications are still needed. And one in particular that was some time, it took the team some time to discuss and feedback after we disseminated the guide out to the public, was that of nebulizers. And we know that nebulizer treatments potentially could cause more transmission of the virus. So shifting, if we could, residents to handheld inhalers. But we know that handheld inhalers may not be used by every resident effectively based on administration. So we had to take into account resident-centered characteristics that might preclude them from using these other alternative treatments to nebulizers. And we also had to take into account availability of some of these inhalers, formulary considerations. So there was a lot of discussion in terms of the effectiveness as well as the availability of these treatments. So that's just one example. So it may seem simple to say, well, we'll just switch nebulizers to handheld inhalers, but it really needs to be person-centered when we take those types of changes to potentially reduce the transmission of the virus at this time.
I'll just add a little bit to what Dr. Erin Brandt was saying. I think she made some really important points. And just to pick up on the individualization theme that she was discussing, you know, it needs to be individualized to the patient's or the resident's sort of clinical characteristics and their abilities, in the example of nebulizers, to be able to take a handheld device as opposed to, you know, wearing a, you know, using a nebulizer device. But also the communication also to a certain extent requires individualization as well. One of the things we were aiming for with this guide was really to hit the low-hanging fruit. There are a number of issues which have long been recognized by the post-acute and long-term care community as important medication-related challenges, for example, related to antipsychotic use and reducing use. We explicitly did not address that in this guide, in part because it's already been addressed very well elsewhere, and in part because these are really hard conversations a lot of the time, and they often can be very time-consuming to address. And our goal with this guide was really to try to do things which are relatively, in quotes, straightforward, or as straightforward as anything else, that can be done quickly and relatively expeditiously. So hopefully many of the medications that we recommend stopping or consolidating, things that are dosed at different times to be dosed altogether, reducing the number of times a day a patient is given pills, those are things which are hopefully fairly uncontroversial for most residents and would be easily accepted. But that said, there are going to be some people who are resistant to those changes. And so in some cases, having individualized communication can be useful. It's not worth, in most situations, getting into a big drawn out battle. And if it looks like there are some residents in the facility who are really opposed to changing a medication, in many cases, probably the best thing to do is just to leave it be. It's just not worth it, you know, in terms of the resident-centered goals of care, combined with the time that you and staff need to do to attend to that, that's not spent doing other things. So it's really, we're looking for, with this guide, a balance, things that are relatively easy to do, that are often going to be accepted by residents and by their loved ones without requiring a tremendous amount of back and forth, but recognizing that maintaining communication and not just throwing changes onto people without explaining it, without hearing their concerns and addressing them, that's too far in that direction is going to be counterproductive as well.
Right.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Steinman and Dr. Nicole Brandt about improving medication management during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Steinman, as a continuation of the previous question, you know, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine and the American Geriatric Society, you know, really endeavor to provide actionable information for their members today that can be used tomorrow. So, at first glance, and I and others have gone through this implementation guide, you know, one might think that this guide is a modified Beers list, but it actually is a completely different type of resource. It, as you've said, it doesn't just spotlight medications of concern. It talks about concepts around medication administration, around dosing, around formulary issues, safe reduction, and discontinuation. How do we most effectively use this guide in general and within the background of the COVID-19 pandemic? I know there's an accompanying checklist. You know, how does this help in the deprescribing exercise as well? Lead us through the action of using this guide.
Well, our hope for this guide is that it's something that will be seen as a valuable resource for people. And the way that it's going to be most valuable is if it's tailored to their individual context. Everyone's going to be dealing with this different set of circumstances. And we realize there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. So we're thinking of the guide in a sort of a menu of options that individual facilities might wish to tailor depending on, implement some recommendations, maybe defer other ones based on what makes the most sense for them and their workflow and their resident population, as well as what's happening with their staff. So that individualization and getting some sort of institutional commitment and sort of understanding about, hey, how do we want to address this and what kind of things might we want to tackle, we think is probably the most useful way to address it. And just to add to what you were saying, I appreciated the fact that you highlighted that this is quite different from the Beers criteria and other lists of drugs that are considered drugs to avoid. It's our focus with this guide really was on things that are fairly simple and easy to do. And a lot of that involves just changing how medications are dosed. So for example, you know, if the person is taking a statin, there's a lot of debate as to whether or not people take statins. But if the patient is taking a statin and they're going to continue taking a statin, for many statins, it really doesn't matter what time of the day it's dosed. It can be given at bedtime as it's awfully dosed. But for many long-acting statins, such as atorvastatin, it's totally fine to give it in the morning. The lipid-lowering effects are exactly the same. And so if giving it at nighttime requires an extra trip to the resident's room and an extra medication pass, why not just consolidate that medication with the morning medications? Or convert a medication that's dosed twice a day to a once-a-day long-acting formulation, if otherwise the clinical effect is expected to be the same for the resident. So, and that's a very different focus than what we have in the Beers criteria. And our goal for these kind of changes is to minimize the burden of frequent medication administration on residents. But at the same time, we're very attentive to the needs that during COVID-19 and any time really, you know, staff are quite burdened with medication passes. It takes up a huge amount of staff time. And if we can safely reduce the number of medication administrations in a way that serves patients' needs and frees up staff time to attend to other activities, that's just a real win because, you know, the staff wins because they have more time and the residents win because the staff is able to attend to their other needs with the extra time they have available.
And Dr. Steinman brought up great points, Wayne, in the fact that every facility is going to take a different approach to using this guide, but I think it's also important that every facility has unique team strengths, and I would hope that as they use this guide, it really brings out those team strengths from the direct care staff to the residents and their families to the consultant pharmacists to the medical directors working together with the nursing administrators and facility administrators, because everybody needs to be in this in alignment to make sure that there's effective communication and support when they're implementing anything, especially during a pandemic and crisis. But I think, as mentioned, the parameters and the tactics have really been grounded in workflow and hopefully also simplifying the demand on that direct care staff.
You know, I want to extend this past comment, Dr. Brandt, and get a even a little bit more granular. So I think it's important. So I've listened to a number of conversations within our facilities in the state of Massachusetts. And the common concern is that staffing is reduced significantly. So you may have one nurse and one CNA for a much larger number of people. The medical director may or may not be as involved as he or she should, and attending physicians have gone on to using telehealth or other modalities, and sometimes there isn't even, you know, a physician available or easily available. Can this guide be used by any member of the multidisciplinary team? So, RNs, LPNs, advanced practitioners. Can anybody, you know, look at this and say, you know, gee, Mr. Smith is on a number of these medications. This would make things easier. Is this the kind of thing that anybody can pick this up and say, listen, I think we can make changes and then go to somebody who has the ability to actually put those orders in place?
Well, Wayne, I'd like to share a story. We've been gathering information about users of the guide, just in terms of numbers, but getting anecdotal stories along the way of people who have used the guide. And one that I think really resonates, because sometimes we forget how important the voice of the family is on the team. But we've actually had we've had individuals download this that are not direct care providers within facilities, but that are family members. And we had one family member of a loved one in an assisted living facility who shared this guide with the doctor and the primary care and said, "I really am worried that my mother's over-medicated," and proceeded to get multiple medications, de-escalated, deprescribed, and completely stopped. And she felt like her mom was more active and more engaged, which was encouraging to her, especially because she was just only able to communicate with her on the telephone and via FaceTime. So I just want to share that, you know, it can be used by every member of this team. And I think the way it's written, you can talk about it in different concepts, from administration to questioning why you're taking a particular medication. So so to your point, absolutely. I think any member of this team, but what I have found through my years of experience with implementing change is you need to have a champion. Yes. So I would hope at a facility level that there would be a champion on the healthcare team that would be willing to report out, this is what's working, this is what isn't, and do some, you know, quick quality changes to ensure that this is something that's helping the facility. And I really think, especially working in long-term care nursing homes, there's so much in terms of looking at quality assurance, performance improvement over time. And we're very mindful of that from a regulatory perspective too, as I'm sure you are, Wayne. So we brought that regulatory consideration aspect into this guide. But if we keep it grounded in resident person-centered care, I think we're all on good footing.
It is so important to empower the frontline staff. And so if we can have one more tool to help do that, especially under a stressful situation, I think that just makes the entire process more powerful. So I definitely applaud you both for doing that.
You know, there's a real important role for all members of the team here. Anytime that you're stopping a medication, it is certainly prudent and advisable to have someone with the appropriate clinical training making that recommendation and making that decision. On the flip side, the people who are providing the frontline care, the CNAs, the RNs, they're the ones who can provide tremendous insights into how patients are taking or residents are taking medications. You know, Mrs. Jones has a real hard time swallowing pills, or I'm going into that room, you know, 10 times a day to administer medications. Is there some way we can consolidate things? Because, you know, the resident really hates that. Or I really think this resident will do well with the handheld inhaler instead of a nebulizer, or this other resident really just not working. So those frontline insights are really essential and can complement the more sort of technical aspects of clinical decision-making that a physician or a pharmacist might bring to the table. And it's really bringing these different pieces together that's going to result in the best outcome.
Yeah. Crucial, absolutely crucial. You know, in the time we have remaining, I want to touch on there's a mention of the regulatory component. And I open this up to both of you. You know, with my last, our last question on this podcast tends to be a little provocative, but not really. You know, I was taken by one of the comments in the key point section, which occurs before the body of the guide, under the regulatory considerations. And it reads, during the COVID-19 pandemic, it is critical to evaluate medication administration, management, and monitoring to ensure that facility teams can continue to meet the needs of each resident. And we've talked about that. It seems to me that, that it's critical to manage medications all the time. And we've talked about this as well. How do we create, for better use of the term, muscle memory in what should be an ongoing process of exploration and considerations around deprescribing or medication management well after this pandemic has passed? You know, I won't ask if the guide will become obsolete, but I'll say, will it assume more shelf time, you know, after the curves have long since flattened, or will it continue to be a viable resource, you know, beyond this pandemic. You know, I was taken by a recent editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association by Phil Fontarosa and Howard Bachner. And I have to ask, you know, can we use your guide as we look beyond tomorrow for healthcare and society?
Thank you, Wayne. I will start with that one. With respect to this guide having legacy beyond the pandemic, my hope is absolutely. I think the principles are well grounded in the fact of reducing burden on our already taxed system of direct care providers. And if there's ways that we can simplify medication regimens, reduce administration times, and reevaluate and have open conversations with our healthcare teams on what's the best medication regimen for the people we care for, that's critical. I also think that what I've learned through this process, it's not just the tool, but it's the connections of a network. And that's why I'm really excited that this hopefully will continue through our work with the USC Prescribing Research Network, because this guide has actually crossed many borders, not just state borders, but international borders, because we're bringing like-minded people together, really interested in optimizing medication and improving medication safety in nursing home settings. So my hope is, yes, this is the beginning of continued and important work in this area, and really highlights the unique angle of caring for older adults and all those residents that live and reside in the post-acute long-term care setting.
I'll just so absolutely second what Dr. Brandt said. And as she alluded to, the guide itself provides a number of concrete recommendations that we think have value, but the process of thinking about the teamwork and how to think about medication regimen improvement and older residents in these facilities, and the process for thinking about consolidation, for thinking about how to get everyone on board about making these changes, we hope will continue as part of that muscle memory, and that will be useful not only for the specific recommendations we made in this guide, but also can be extended to a variety of other initiatives to improve care quality, both for medications and for other activities in the longer term.
We have been so fortunate to listen to and learn from Dr. Michael Steinman and Dr. Nicole Branch regarding their implementation guide for medical management around the COVID-19 pandemic and beyond. Dr. Steinman and Dr. Branch, thank you so very much for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Wayne.
Thanks for having us, Wayne.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.org/podcast. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.